of the problems that Black communities suffered through.
And you certainly help us do this in this remarkable documentary. Stanley Nelson, the award-winning director of the new documentary Tulsa Burning, the 1921 Race Massacre, premieres Sunday at 8 p.m. Eastern on the History Channel. And that does it for our show. Our condolences to our dear colleague, Miriam Barnard. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Stay safe.
Tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland and Multnomah County have agreed on short and long-term plans for the houseless community. Clackamas is the last Portland county still at high risk for coronavirus, and the state attorney general has joined others calling Second Amendment sanctuary ordinances invalid. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 28th, 2021. I'm Nat Moon. Yesterday, the Oregon Health Authority announced 433 new or presumed COVID-19 infections and 21 deaths, including a 15-year-old boy from Marion County. The agency also noted that the state had passed 200,000 cases since the start of the pandemic. Although the OHA did not release details, it's likely that yesterday's high death toll included fatalities that may have occurred over recent weeks but were not linked to COVID-19 until then. As a result of the spring surge in cases and hospitalizations, May is expected to exceed the March and April death tolls, but still fall below the December peak, when nearly 600 Oregonians lost their lives. The agency also announced that six cases of the highly transmissible variant that has ravaged India have now been identified in Oregon. This strain appears to be as much as 50% more contagious than the so-called UK variant, which has been the dominant strain in Oregon since early March. The UK variant was estimated to be 50% more contagious than the original strain. Healthcare workers remain concerned that large, unvaccinated populations continue to allow new and potentially more infectious variants of the coronavirus to evolve, but a recent study has found that the Pfizer vaccine is nearly 90% effective in preventing symptomatic disease of even the new variant among fully vaccinated people. Now that Multnomah has joined Washington County in the lower risk category, Clackamas is the last of the three counties that make up the greater Portland area to remain in high risk. In order to move to lower risk, 65% of Clackamas County adults need to have at least one COVID-19 vaccine dose, and the county needs to submit an equity plan for vaccinations. County officials are apparently finalizing their equity plan now, but a bigger issue is not having enough vaccinated residents. At over 1,800 square miles, Clackamas is 50% larger than the combined land area of Multnomah and Washington counties, but has only about 25% of the population, and many of the more rural areas of the county have been slow to get vaccinated. According to Philip Mason Joyner, the director of Clackamas County Public Health, over 200 doses have been administered so far, and an additional 15,000 residents need to be vaccinated in order to reach the 65% threshold. He said the plan is to have more local community shot clinics at schools, plus working with businesses to offer more mobile on-site shot clinics to make it easier for workers to get vaccinated. In comments to COIN, Mason Joyner said, quote, "Our clinics in Estacada and Welch's on the Mountain, they've said if you hadn't brought the vaccine to us, we wouldn't have gotten it. Those clinics will be critical to reach folks." The Oregon State Hospital has requested 30 registered nurses from the National Guard. The call is the last step in a five-step emergency plan the hospital created in November and comes as the number of staffers out on coronavirus-related leave continues to grow. On Tuesday, the state psychiatric hospital said it would pull in managers from the Oregon Health Authority and other state agencies to help provide temporary staffing. The hospital houses about 650 patients and over 2,000 employees between its Salem and Junction City locations. The call for National Guard help means that the hospital is now down to 50% or less of its full-time staff of more than 900 nurses. A federal judge also granted a hospital administration request to temporarily halt admissions because of their inability to discharge patients fast enough to make room for new ones. This is the fifth pause in admissions since the start of the pandemic last year. The growing staff shortage has hit the remaining staff hard, resulting in longer shifts and other job-related stress. Kim Thomas, an administrative specialist and president of the SEIU Local 503 Union, said, quote, "Our staff are feeling the strain of that because there aren't as many people to respond to emergencies. People are quitting who've been here for a long time. It's just progressively getting worse with morale because people are so exhausted." While the state hospital did have several coronavirus outbreaks among staff and patients, most of those on leave are not sick with the virus, but taking childcare leave. The COVID-19 crisis has severely impacted childcare centers and in-person schooling around the state. After working through a tough year and a pandemic, hospital workers in Albany, Oregon, are calling for Good Samaritan Health Services to improve working conditions as they negotiate a new union contract. For more on the story, here's Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service.
A group of hospital workers in Oregon wants more from its employer after what the workers say has been an especially tough pandemic year. Samaritan Health Service workers in Albany held an informational picket this week, calling on management to continue bargaining on their union contracts, which started in February. Paige Bond, a certified nursing assistant at Samaritan Albany General Hospital, says workers have been called heroes during the pandemic, but the hospital hasn't gone a step further with support, like hazard bonuses and other measures.
Child care places shut down, and help with child care would have been great. We haven't seen anything from them as far as COVID protections go, and it's a little bit of a slap in the face.
The workers are part of SEIU Local 49. The local represents roughly 1,000 Samaritan workers, with about half of its members at Albany General Hospital and Good Samaritan Regional Medical Center in bargaining right now. Samaritan Health Services says at the end of 2020, it gave employees who missed up to 80 hours of work time because of COVID-19 a lump sum payment, or replenished paid time off. Bond notes that a local nursing home has a starting salary that's more than $4 higher per hour for CNAs than the hospital. She believes low wages and the potential for increasing healthcare costs will lead workers to leave Samaritan.
Me personally, it's getting to the point where it's almost too expensive to work for Samaritan.
Samaritan says its pay is competitive and that it's offering across-the-board pay increases in negotiations with SEIU. It also says its premiums are lower than other institutions in the state, and increases would be negligible. Bond hopes the informational picket will be enough to push management forward on their contract.
People are tired and burnt out and can't afford to pay their rent and their health care. They're having to make some really tough choices, and it shouldn't take this kind of thing to get the management to see that.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedov.
Oregon may be adopting one of the country's most ambitious deadlines to eliminate carbon dioxide emissions from its power grid under a bill that advanced this week. House Bill 2021 sets a timetable by which Oregon's power companies must eliminate emissions associated with the electricity they provide, and it comes as the result of intense negotiations between power companies, environmental justice groups, renewable energy boosters, and other community groups. The bill advanced out of a House committee and must now go through the state budgeting process before a final vote in the House and Senate. Portland General Electric and Pacific Power are the main suppliers of power in the state, but even power companies will be affected by the bill. For PGE and Pacific Power, the bill requires both companies to submit plans to reduce emissions by 80% of a baseline amount by 2030, 90% by 2035, and the complete elimination of emissions by 2040. Carbon emissions will be tracked by the state's Department of Environmental Quality. The bill also bans construction or expansion of power plants that burn natural gas or other fossil fuels and requires power companies to take input from low-income ratepayers, environmental justice communities, and federally recognized tribes to help develop emission-reducing strategies. HB 2021 got its start last summer shortly after Republicans cut 2020's legislative session short with a walkout over a Democratic proposal for a cap-and-trade system to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But because it only tackles a segment of the state's carbon dioxide output, the new bill has received little pushback. According to the DEQ, emissions from electricity account for roughly 30% of statewide levels. Emissions from cars, trucks, and other forms of transportation are the largest contributor of CO2. Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum is joining the fight to have Columbia County's Second Amendment sanctuary ordinance declared invalid. The ordinance, which would effectively bar local law enforcement from enforcing almost any restrictions on gun sales or ownership within Columbia County, was approved by voters last year. But according to Rosenblum, the ordinance and the ballot measures that it's based on, quote, conflict with and are incompatible with the state's criminal laws, the duties of the Columbia County Sheriff, the duties of the Columbia County District Attorney, and the duties of other officers and departments of Columbia County. She was joined by four other interested parties who also filed in opposition to the ordinance. One of the four is former Scappoose School Board member Joe Lewis, who was one of the nine people injured by Ohio National Guard troops who opened fire on anti-war protesters at Kent State University in 1970. The effort to have the ordinance invalidated is supported by members of Everytown Law, the legal arm of the gun control nonprofit Everytown for Gun Safety. In a press release, Everytown Law Managing Director said that both state law and the U.S. Constitution make it clear that, quote, local governments don't have the legal authority to pick and choose which public safety laws apply within their borders. A bill that would allow motorcyclists to drive between slow or stopped traffic was vetoed this week by Governor Kate Brown. Brown sent a letter to the House and Senate on Wednesday with her decision, citing public safety concerns for the practice known as lane splitting or lane filtering. Senate Bill 574 received bipartisan approval as well as hundreds of letters in support and would have allowed motorcyclists to drive between lanes on multi-lane highways when traffic slowed to 10 miles per hour or less. Supporters maintain that lane splitting helps riders avoid being rear-ended in stop-and-go traffic and lightens congestion for other drivers. But in a letter to Senate President Peter Courtney and House Speaker Tina Kotek, Brown disagreed, saying, quote, "I have several concerns with the bill as currently drafted, particularly related to public safety and noncompliance." The governor added that she was worried riders would not comply with the narrow provisions of the new law, which only allows lane splitting in multi-lane highways where the speed limit is 50 miles per hour or higher. Critics of the legislation have voiced concerns that the practice could spill onto city streets and that lane splitting puts motorcyclists in the blind spots of other drivers. It seems unlikely that the legislature will try to override the veto. An override would need a two-thirds vote in each chamber, and the initial passage fell short of that number. A recent study has shown that law enforcement officers find Oregon's marijuana laws to be unclear and confusing, leading some to stop enforcing them altogether. Portland State University researchers Chris Henning and Greg Stewart surveyed 301 police officers in a report on the perception of the state's marijuana regulation laws. The report, entitled, quote, "Dazed and Confused, Police Experiences Enforcing Oregon's New Marijuana Laws," surveyed officers from the Deschutes County Sheriff's Office, the Klamath County Sheriff's Office, and both Bend and Redmond Police Departments. In 2014, voters approved Measure 91, legalizing recreational use of cannabis-based products for people 21 and older, resulting in a rapid change in the state's marijuana laws. In 2018 and again in 2019, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission also modified and tightened its licensing guidelines. The remaining areas where marijuana offenses are still charged include driving while impaired, possessing illegal amounts of marijuana, and the illegal growing, processing, and distribution of marijuana. But 3 out of 4 officers surveyed said they were confused by the new laws, and that many felt they were intentionally vague to minimize enforcement. Others described difficulty in determining if a person possessed an illegal amount of cannabis, as well as confusion regarding enforcement measures for recreational marijuana versus medical marijuana. One officer responded to a survey calling the laws too convoluted to comprehend, maintaining that if the police have trouble deciphering them, how can citizens be expected to understand them? Many officers indicated a hesitancy to make arrests, feeling district attorneys would likely not prosecute the cases. Despite the study's results, police department and sheriff's office spokespeople maintain resources are available for officers to acquaint themselves with state marijuana laws, and that determining probable cause for arrest is the same as with alcohol DUIs. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Coming up next, at 5:30, it's Counterspin. At 6, it's Let's Talk About Race. Then at 7, it's Rising Up with Sana Lee. Tonight will be clear with an overnight low of about 50. And tomorrow, we'll see morning clouds give way to a sunny day with an afternoon high near 80. On this day in 1830, U.S. President Andrew Jackson signed the Indian Removal Act. The law allowed for the forced removal of the Cherokee, Chickasaw, Choctaw, Creek, and Seminole people from their established autonomous nations in the southeastern United States, and their forced relocation to federal territory west of the Mississippi River. Today's quote is from Lieutenant John Phelps, who assisted with the removal. Phelps said, quote, "I could not help but think that some fearful retribution would come upon us. The scene seemed to me like a distempered dream, or something worthy of the Dark Ages rather than a present reality." Voting rights activists and tribal leaders worked to defeat an Arizona voter ID law. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Arizona legislature has narrowly defeated a controversial bill that would have required voters to include identification with their early ballots. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports voting rights advocates and tribal leaders opposed the measure.
The legislation would have required that voters include an ID number along with their birth date on all mail-in ballots in Arizona. It was one of the most contentious of several bills Republican lawmakers introduced after former President Donald Trump lost in the state last year by fewer than 11,000 votes. Navajo Nation leaders have called the legislation voter suppression and say it would have added another step in an already difficult voting process for many on the vast and remote reservation. Tribal officials point out that many elders weren't born in hospitals and as a result don't have consistent birth dates across all of their IDs, making it more likely their ballots could be rejected. Navajo officials were also concerned that some tribal IDs wouldn't be accepted by election officials. Arizona Republican Governor Doug Ducey has signed at least a dozen voting-related bills into law this year. Supporters say they make elections more secure and efficient and give voters added confidence in the results. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
Alaska's only reservation is facing its worst COVID-19 outbreak to date. As Eric Stone reports, this week officials in Metlakatla announced the community's second death linked to the disease.
At the beginning of May, authorities in Metlakatla had reported only 13 cases of COVID-19 on Annette Island since the start of the pandemic. Strict travel protocols, a mask mandate, and distancing rules seemed to be working. But on May 10th, five people in the community tested positive. And at first, Metlakatla Indian Community Mayor Reginald Atkinson says it seemed like authorities had a handle on the outbreak. But then more and more cases started cropping up.
After this outbreak, it became entered into the community spread phase, which went kind of like wildfire.
Metlakatla has seen about 30 cases since May 10th. That's more than twice the total number of cases reported prior to that date. The roughly 1,000-person community hit an all-time high of 21 active COVID-19 cases last week.
By the end of this past weekend, it was pretty tense.
Atkinson says the rash of infections has strained local contact tracing capacity. And now the outbreak has claimed the life of a Metlakatla resident. It's the community's second COVID-19 death. State public health officials say Metlakatla's outbreak appears to be slowing, though. The last new case was reported May 21st, and the number of active cases is trending down. Reporting from Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
A statue of Christopher Columbus will not return to Discovery Park in Chula Vista, California. The San Diego Union-Tribune reports the decision was made this week by the city council. The council voted 4-1 on its permanent removal and to replace the statue with something that reflects the community. Last year, the city removed the statue and placed it in storage ahead of protests following George Floyd's death. Protests against racism and police violence were held across the country and reignited calls to remove controversial statues of military leaders and colonizers. A local indigenous group led calls for the removal of the Columbus statue, saying it's a symbol of genocide. They're also seeking a renaming of Discovery Park and recognition of Indigenous Peoples Day. Bipartisan legislation to address funding for child abuse prevention in Indian Country was reintroduced this week in Congress. The American Indian and Alaska Native Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act provides resources for tribes. Child welfare groups are supporting the legislation. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Despite pleas from the mother of Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick, Republican senators appear ready to filibuster the vote on establishing a commission to study the January 6th insurrection. With more on that story and others, here's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We need to know the whole truth about January 6th.
It was a busy day in the Senate on Thursday. California Senator Alex Padilla made an impassioned plea in favor of a commission to study the breach of the U.S. Capitol.
The Confederate flag, the symbol of violent white supremacy, flew inside this Capitol for the first time in our nation's history.
Gladys Sicknick, the mother of Capitol Officer Brian Sicknick, who suffered a stroke and died a day after the attack, met with Republicans to urge them to vote in favor of the commission.
I couldn't stay quiet anymore.
As of deadline, Republicans were expected to filibuster the measure. If so, Democrats would need the votes of at least 10 GOP senators to pass it. In the House, 35 Republicans voted for the commission. The Senate did advance sweeping bipartisan legislation aimed at boosting the country's ability to compete with China. Senators voted to end debate on the $250 billion U.S. Innovation and Competition Act, which invests in increased production of microchips and other technology. The White House said it will continue talks on infrastructure next week. Republicans have made a $928 billion counteroffer to the administration's $1.7 trillion plan. But the GOP proposal was quickly shot down by many Democrats, including Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro.
I was disappointed from the Senate Republican proposal to gut the child tax credit to pay for the infrastructure package. This would practically double child poverty and increase taxes on middle-class families. And I would just say, not on our watch.
President Joe Biden's first budget proposal will be released today. It's expected to include increased taxes on the wealthy and corporations and the highest sustained level of spending since World War II. The $6 trillion plan is already drawing fire from Republicans. Here's Congressman Steve Womack of Arkansas.
I'm concerned that this excessive level of federal spending by the administration will lead to both inflation and massive debt that will hinder the recovery and burden future generations.
However, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen noted that inflation-adjusted spending has not increased in a decade.
It's critically important that we have a responsible fiscal policy and not burden our children and their children with tax increases that will rob them of chances to achieve prosperity.
At a stop in Cleveland, Biden took a stab at Republicans who voted against the American Rescue Plan and then promoted it back home.
Some people have no shame. But I'm happy. I'm happy they know that it benefited their constituents.
The First Lady was also on the road Thursday, encouraging Michigan college students to get vaccinated against COVID-19.
Vaccines are the best way for all of us to get back to the weddings and the sporting events and the concerts that we all miss so much.
About 60% of all adults have received at least one dose, still below the 70% benchmark recommended by health experts. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
The Texas legislature has passed laws to further restrict abortion and allow the unlicensed carrying of handguns, but seems unable to come up with a bill to improve the state's under-regulated power grid. For more on the story, here's Roz Brown with the Public News Service.
With days remaining for Texas lawmakers to pass legislation to avoid future statewide blackouts like the one that occurred in February, there doesn't appear to be much movement on the issue. More than 4 million customers lost electricity after a freak winter storm crippled the state's electric grid, killing at least 150 people. President of the Texas Consumer Association, Sandra Haverlaw, says doing nothing before the session ends next Monday is not acceptable.
People died. People died from the winter storm, and we cannot just say that the state should move forward. Something has to be done before we enter the summer and before this happens again.
Texas is the fastest growing state in the nation, adding 374,000 residents in 2020, either through births or people moving in, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Its power supply is connected to a grid entirely within state lines, limiting transfers from other grids in the event of a blackout. Reviewing federal mortality data, the news site BuzzFeed released an updated estimate on Thursday that 702 people died during the week of the storm. Nonetheless, lawmakers have yet to finalize a bill that would improve the state's power system, even though Haverlaw says proposed legislation laid out what would be needed to avoid a future catastrophe.
Weatherization from wellhead all the way through the infrastructure to the home, designating critical infrastructure, which and improving communication between the agencies.
Last week, Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed one of the nation's most restrictive abortion measures and has already said he'll sign a bill passed this week that will allow most Texans to carry concealed handguns without a permit. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 28th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Jeffrey Wade, Ray Bodwell, Antonia Gonzalez, Roz Brown, Mary Sherman, and Eric Tegedoff. The producer is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is Otto. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Nat Moon.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the May 25th New York Times reports that India's leading Bharatiya Janata Party is pressuring Twitter to censor and sanction anyone posting critically about Prime Minister Narendra Modi. And after dusk,